Well, hey y'all, I'm Brian Boggs, and for those of you who don't know much about me, I've been making chairs for 35 years and loving every bit of it. I've had the opportunity to teach chair making around the United States in various woodworking schools and some internationally. And it's been several years since I've been directly involved with teaching or really much reach out to the woodworking community. So I'm glad to be back in touch with you guys. So today we're going to pick up a few questions that have been sent in already.
John Paver asks, what is your favorite wood to work with?
Well, the short answer to that is I don't have one. It really depends on what exactly I'm doing. You know, for several years, I've made post and rung chairs and in the greenwood tradition where the legs had some moisture content in them still from the tree, and the stretchers were super dry. And for that type of construction, the ideal combination is either red maple or sugar maple for the legs and hickory for the stretchers. Either wood for the slats was fine. The reason that those two were a great choice is the maple had a resilience that allowed the leg to deform as it shrank around the exact shape of the rung, and it had a way of giving and clamping back down as the wood changed moisture content. And it didn't let go of the rung. The rung, as hickory, had enough hardness to resist the crushing of the green wood as it shrank and could hold its shape so that the green wood could deform around it. So that was a wonderful combination of two things. Plus, the maple turned well and shaved well for legs, and hickory, if it split, was a great shaving wood for the rungs. As I got into working with other woods, cherry, walnut, and even oak and ash, it seemed that the wide range of densities and strengths required rethinking of the joinery. And so if you look closely at some of my newer designs, you'll notice that the joinery is considerably more massive, and that is to take better advantage of the properties of cherry and walnut. Maple, oak, ash, hickory all were fine as post and rung construction, but to get into more contemporary forms, I wanted to eliminate a lot of the busyness of the undercarriage that the post and rungs have. And I also wanted to play more with other forms for back and seat and even arm shapes. So I also wanted to have designs that allowed me to use the wood that I wanted from an aesthetic standpoint, and that meant usually larger, more massive joinery than traditional post and rung, which didn't really require hickory, but greatly benefited from hickory in the rungs. When I made a cherry rocking chair that was a post and rung, I would always use either oak and hickory in the seat, in the seat stretchers. The visible stretchers, our clients wanted to have a matching wood, so I would use cherry or walnut there, whatever the frame was made out of. For tables, you know, I'll select a different log, but I like all of the woods, and we try to get at least a symmetrical two-board pattern, a book-match two boards, or if it's four boards, we'll match it in such a way that it flows across the table as a symmetrical picture, even if it's four boards. So I love all the woods, and it's not that there is one wood that stands out above the others. There's sometimes one wood that really shines particularly well for a particular project. And it's not just species, it may be a specific log that's just the right one to work with. So thanks for that question, that's a good one.
Bo Hooper writes, glad to hear about the new show. I've admired your work for years and will be watching. I really enjoy making the ladder back chairs as taught by Jenny Alexander. I learned from watching the Green Woodworking DVDs. I think these chairs have a wonderful regional heritage here in Georgia, and I love the simple, quite elegance of the design and construction. My question is, what would be a fair selling price for these? I have only made a few of them, so my speed isn't quite there, and I make them by myself in my home workshop, so overhead isn't a big issue for me. Would love your thoughts.
That's a big one. And I owe a lot of gratitude toward Jenny Alexander, and it's the book he wrote, she wrote, Make a Chair from a Tree, that opened the door for me to get into woodworking. It wasn't that chair making was the first thing that inspired me to pick up wood and try to work with it. It was the accessibility that the low, you know, the simple process, the few tools required, that and allowed me to set up my first shop for $50. So thank you very much for all that information and inspiration to get going. In terms of value and cost and price and how you make things and how does that all come into figuring out what you should charge a client for making a chair, it's an impossible equation to create, to figure out how much to charge for something as you're starting out. Basically, there are certain rules that, you know, your material should be a certain percentage, your labor should be a certain percentage, or you could just, you know, double your materials and that should come out right. But for chair making, the materials cost is so low relative to your labor cost that those formulas don't really apply. What does apply to understanding what's a fair price for your greenwood chair is the same as what makes a fair price for anything that you sell, and that is based on a clear understanding of what value you're really creating in the process of making your chair or other piece of furniture. So the key is really in being able to sell pieces successfully. The key isn't pricing it right or building it efficiently. The key is in creating a value that is desired by the public. And that starts off with inspired design, which is based on a really sound mastery of construction. And starting out, everything is tough. And if you're in a position where you have income or financial support that doesn't require that you make a big profit on your chairs, you're fortunate. In fact, that may be a requirement for getting into this. Because you've got to get to a point to where you're fluid enough with production and understanding the process so that you can make a chair. You know, a greenwood two-slat chair should be a 10-hour process. At the most, a 15-hour process total, log to finish. That's what I was doing before I got any electrical tools. But what that's worth has nothing to do with how long it took to make it or what it's made of. You can spend 200 hours on a piece, make it out of walnut, and maybe it's not worth $20 because of the design. So design is really key. You know, what are you bringing to the furniture world with this? What's important about what you're doing? The tradition of greenwood chair making is a beautiful tradition, and it's proven that the frames can last for a long time. But that's not enough to generate a value that will support the time that you put into it. Creating enough value to make it worth your time to generate those chairs requires a mastery level of both design and process for making it that can move you through from log to finished piece fluidly enough that what you've invested in that is less than what your clients are willing to invest in it. Otherwise, there's no margin. And that's just a tricky thing. But an example is we have tried many times to design and build chairs for a price that's less than the standard three-slat ladder back that I've been making for decades. And the first time that we tried that, well, a recent time that we tried that was in our last shop, I think it was about 6 years ago, that I redesigned the greenwood chair, simplified it, and allowed for a more rustic finish, thinking that we could sell them for significantly less money. And we came up with a price of $850 when our three-slant ladder back was selling for, I think, $1,500. So just a little above half price. We sold a few right away, but basically sales flattened out and disappeared. And the reason is that it was a very good chair, they'll last for just about forever. It didn't have the pizzazz or fit the interiors of our clients as well as what we call our classic ladder back. So regardless of what we think we need to sell for something, it doesn't mean that we have created a value that justifies the production of a thing. So you'll just have to experiment with design, process, and learn, get to know your clients and find out what's going to be a fit between the materials you have to work with, the limitations of the infrastructure of your shop, and the creativity of your designs. That's all got to be spun with a little magic to create a value that will support your craftsmanship.
I've got two questions coming in from Instagram. I can just give them to you both. You can decide which one you want to take. From John Victor Goldberg, what are your thoughts on sustainability, locally sourced wood, renewable as a source for shop energy? That's one. And then Gabe Picot. Okay. Yeah, what is your favorite finish for tabletops?
Gabe, you dog. Okay, I'll take the other one. Sustainability, I mean, books are written on sustainability. And, you know, for us, the company has to be sustainable, or what we're doing isn't going to be sustainable. We have to make the whole picture work. And so we grapple with a level of sustainability that we can accommodate. That means sourcing our wood practically, but also knowing that the places that we're buying our wood are getting their logs, and for the most part we do buy logs, we do buy some lumber, but American hardwoods are generally, the lumber is generally sustainably sourced by law. The mahogany that we get from Honduras, we know the people that we're working with there and have known them for quite some time, and we know that that's sustainably sourced. But buying your materials from a source that is quote unquote sustainable is a tiny part of what makes your overall effort something that can be done for generations. And quite frankly, I don't think we're really at that point. We source our materials sustainably. We have a company that comes in that composts our wood shavings. We make sure that our scrap is either sold by the pound to be reused for other purposes by other craftsmen, or we use it for fuel. We minimize our trash as much as we can, but we're still using electricity that's generated by coal or gas, and as long as we're doing that, there's an issue. It's fossil fuel. So we're working toward increasing our sustainability. We're getting LED lights put into the shop. As soon as we can, we've got the proposal going now, and we've got electricians here assessing what exactly needs to be done. Gabe's question got skipped over. Gabe, I don't have a favorite finish. I basically hate them all right now.
Tinker Trading Company asks, when using turned legs, is it necessary to have tapered tenons and reamed holes, or can a straight wedge tenon hold fine?
This question opens up a whole lot of what I've been doing in experimenting with joints, how they behave, how glue works, and how do you assemble a tight joint where the sides of the tenon are parallel to each other, whether it's a round tenon, a rectangular tenon, or a bridle joint. The issue of assembly is key. So the question of whether or not it's tapered, While that's important, what's more important is the precision of both parts, the mortise and tenon, the fit, the quality of the surface on both parts so that it's not torn up, so that it's a good clean cut, so that you can get a good bond, and the type of wood you're using for that joint. For example, when we're building our post and rung chairs, for many years I was using high glue, and the rungs are 4% moisture content. The legs are anywhere from 12 to 18% moisture content. And we're using high glue, so we can put a thin coat of glue on both parts, let that dry, reactivate it with a hot high glue, which can bond really well and allow the joint to slip together even though it's tight without shearing the glue off of either part. Yellow glue in that situation doesn't give as good a bond because too much of the glue gets sheared off and shoved to the bottom of the hole or peeled off the tenon and left on the surface of the chair. That's the biggest advantage of a tapered joint. It doesn't get tight until it's almost all the way home, and then it's pressing the wall of the tenon against the wall of the mortise with a clamping force that bonds that glue really well, even against ingrain. That's the biggest advantage of the tapered joints in winter chair making. I don't know a bit that will cut tapered holes appropriate for porcelain rung joinery. Is that okay?
You got time? Shut down.
Storage.
So, wedge tenon, I think, is only theoretically good. I think you're causing more problems than it's worthwhile. You just don't need to wedge a blind tenon. A well-fitted tenon is about as good as it gets. If the fit is good, the moisture content is correct, and the precision of the surface is such that you get a good glue bond, a wedge is just not going to help the situation.
Carl Hudson 84 asks, when designing a new chair, do you have a preferred material that you use, or is it just whatever you have laying around?
I think that the person asking this question is referring to the prototyping process, and we keep wood on hand for that. Depending on the design, I might choose pine, poplar, or if it's a part that is under a lot of strain and we're actually going to test the seat of the chair, the sit quality of the chair, then I would more likely use red maple. I keep all of those woods on hand because they work quickly, work easily, and they're relatively inexpensive. I will often use plywood if it works for a specific part. I'll model pieces in just whatever I've got laying around. I use a lot of MDF. We don't use a lot of MDF for modeling, but I will often use MDF modeling. We don't consume that much of it. So it just depends on what I'm trying to do. Sometimes it's actually because we're always set up for steam bending and we have a lot of forms already of different shapes. I can often generate a steam bend quicker than I can create that part in another wood. And in that case, I'll use probably soft maple because it bends well and sets very quickly. So it just depends on what the design is, what the demands of that design are, and how far I want to go into prototyping and what questions I want to ask or answer in the prototyping process. I no longer need to really test the sit quality of a chair because we've got those lines, angles, and curves recorded. So I know what those are. Those are standard for every design. What I'm often testing, almost exclusively testing, is what the piece looks like in the 3D form as you walk around it. How do all of those parts relate to each other? And does it feel like the image felt like when it first came to me? And to do that, it doesn't really matter what the wood is. I will often paint the piece black so that I can better see it and see how the parts relate.
Mahogany House Woodworks asks, how do you value your work? Price and see how the market accepts, raise and lower accordingly, or commissions? It's tough when not knowing how long a project will take.
Well, that I think we can pick up on the answer to the other question, which is a little bit different, and it refers to this one referring to our own work. And it's a little bit easier because I've been doing this for 35 years, and I've done so many different types of things. I know what a piece should cost based on its complexity. And if I'm building a piece that I have never built before, I will often go online and look at what comparable pieces or pieces of comparable complexity are selling for. And I know that ours is going to cost more because we invariably will put more into it than just about any other shop. And what I mean by that is the detailing, the joinery, the engineering behind it, especially if it's a chair. With a chair, I don't go online to look at comps. I know what those need to sell for. But tables and custom desks, sometimes I will go online. But the stuff that we're doing now is so different. I just go with a gut feeling about, based on its complexity, how long it will take. And, you know, if it's going to take 8 hours, it's an $800 piece. You know, that generally covers overhead, material, labor, our margins, our marketing. And if we do a really good job, we've got money left over to fire up the next design. So there's not a real rule of thumb to follow that makes the math easier. You've got to be able to draw on some experience, or if you have no experience building it, let's say it's a table or if it's a Windsor chair, just look at the market. And if you're coming into it new, you probably will have to price your work below what most of the market for similar quality stuff is, because you don't have the reputation that your competition does. So, and that's just something you'll have to earn through the school of hard knocks, you know, just get out there and start producing it. One of the things that is really critical in all of this is to not work above your level. And that's something that takes a lot of discipline. By that I mean you don't want to be having most of the work that you're putting out be something that challenges your craftsmanship to the max, unless you're already established well enough that you can charge your clients enough for you to go to school on every piece. You want to have some bread and butter stuff. You want to have some work that you can really flow through the shop with. And that the same is true for our shop. You know, there's a certain volume of our production that we want to be routine, easy stuff so that we're not going crazy with every piece. Our outdoor line is like that. Our ladder backs are pretty much like that. We've been making those for a long time. The Sonus Lily and Sonus, or the Lily bar stools, we've been making those for years now. So that's a pretty fluid, reliable, not constantly reinventing the wheel, the lines that allow us to have a custom arena that's part of our company where we can take risks, explore, and do things that push the envelope for our creativity. So those are all things that are important aspects of price and marketing strategy. Well, this has been interesting. Hope you all found this informative, useful, inspiring, and look forward to joining you again soon.